Okay, so we're all definitely interested in this light WIMP mass region, where we have several experiments that see interesting results, and then other experiments that don't see anything. And there's this real question is, are these experiments, how many of them are consistent with each other? Because there seem to be some incompatibilities. And I want to just look at some of the statistics, some statistical issues that go into deriving these regions. And I'm going to go through various examples, showing examples of weak statistical tests, some cases where some of these regions are based on flawed or misleading statistics, some analyses that are some statistical tests. If I have some time, I'll talk about some possibly over-conservative uses of statistics. So for compatibility, ideally what we'd want to do is a joint likelihood analysis of all these experiments. Put them in one statistical test, work out whether it's consistent. The real problem here is that some of these experiments don't have background estimates, which means you can't really construct a likelihood, which makes doing a joint likelihood really difficult. Instead, some of these experiments use some statistical technique, such as the maximum gap, optimum interval methods, where they place an upper limit on some p-value that you could get if you did know your backgrounds. You're just placing an upper limit on this p-value, and from that you can exclude regions of parameter space that you know are a poor fit to the data, even if you don't know what your backgrounds are. So what we then do now to try and look at compatibility is just plot a bunch of separate regions based on likelihoods for individual experiments or exclusion regions like this, and look for where those regions overlap. And that's where we say if these experiments are compatible or not. So the type of regions we produce, we have these exclusion regions. These gap methods, things like this, are really a non-goodness of fit indicator. They indicate regions that are excluded because the goodness of fit is terrible. But because of there are no background subtraction, they don't actually tell you that regions below this exclusion curve are good fits. Right? You just know everything above that is bad. If you're able to figure out what your backgrounds are and do a real background subtraction analysis, you can find that there are regions below this exclusion curve that should also be excluded. Okay? So these are very conservative exclusion curves. Another type of region you can show is if you can develop a likelihood is a delta chi-squared confidence region, especially if you have some type of chi-square setting. But you have to be careful when you're plotting these regions because these regions are not an indicator of goodness of fit. Right? If we're trying to look at compatibility of different experiments, we're trying to look at regions of the parameter space that have good fits to many different experiments. These regions here do not tell you that, not directly. The goodness of fit is coming entirely within this chi-squared minimum. Separate test, if you plot one of these regions, you can find that it's containing parameters that are actually a poor fit to your model, because this is the part that actually tells you whether it's a good fit or not. So you have to be real careful if you show a region like this, and you're trying to look at overlapping regions. You have to be careful interpreting what that means. Alternatively, you could do something which is just to plot the regions in your parameter space that do give a good goodness of fit, just based on the overall chi-square, not the delta chi-square. In terms of confidence regions, it's generally weaker than doing a delta chi-square, but it does address this question of are your parameters reasonably, is your data reasonably well fit by that parameter space? Now, these types of regions, when you combine different results using these types of regions, it's the best indicator of whether what you would expect to see if you could do an ideal joint analysis. However, there are some issues. Chi-squared goodness of fits, when we're doing bin data, those tests can be rather weak if you have a poor choice of binning. Unless this talk sounds like I'm just complaining about it, what everyone else is doing in the field, this was an issue we had in this paper here, looking at DAMA data. We didn't do a very good job binning. Referee pointed this out, and we had to go correct this. all right, so to look at what this is, this was alluded to by Kelso. Looking at the DAMA data, you have the measured modulation amplitude at different energies. The data as they present it is in 36 bins from 2 to 20 keV, so I'm not showing a bunch of bins up here. You can do a fit, your very simple case of a WIMP with spin-independent couplings, so spin-independent cross-section and mass. Minimize over those two parameters, and you find two minima in your chi-squared. The global minima, which corresponds to what I'll call a heavy WIMP, but basically 70 GeV. And then a second local minima corresponding to a WIMP at 10 GeV. And in this analysis, you can take a look at the chi-squares of these two fits, about 35 and 37 on 34 degrees of freedom, so reasonably good fits both cases. Now, if we look at the regions in parameter space that have a reasonable goodness of fit here, in terms of the spin-independent cross-section and the mass, here are these two regions, okay? 90% and 3 sigma contours. And here's an example. This is the xenon 100 90% exclusion level, or exclusion curve here. So everything over here is excluded at the 90% level. These are the regions that work well for DAMA. Okay? This particular case, we can see that xenon's excluding the DAMA region, but they're relatively close here. There's about a 1 GeV difference in mass between these two regions here. So this is where you can turn some knobs, play with quenching factors, halo models, things like that, to try and shift them against each other. Maybe get the xenon constraint to move over just enough where you have a little bit of region that is compatible between the two of them. Okay. And you only need to move it about 1 GeV there. Okay. However, as Kelso pointed out, when you use these 36 bins, you have a lot of useless degrees of freedom in there. One is that, the energy resolution of the DAMA detector is much broader than the width of the bins that they give. So these bins are not useful for constraining the shape of this modulation spectrum. You have too many of them. In addition, you have a lot of bins at high energy where you'll never expect signal, regardless of what your WIMP model is. Right? So they're not useful up here. You have way too many bins. And that just weakens your goodness of fit. And so we looked into what's a better way of optimizing the bins that you should use. So we started combining bins smaller than much smaller than the energy resolution of the detector. to address the first point. Then the second point is we scanned over basically the whole WIMP parameter space to try and identify at which energy we can just combine all the above bins into one bin without reducing the sensitivity of our test. And we found that to be at 7 keV. Well, it comes down to this. When you have lots of bins, you're adding just a lot of random fluctuations, right? So if you have one or two bins here that are off by a few sigma from your best fit, that bad fit is going to be hidden by all the statistical noise that's coming in from these excess bins down here. So you weaken your chi-square. But you're doing a better job with the degrees of freedom. I'll show that here. No, you can do better. So you can improve the goodness of fit. Okay, by combining bins, you could potentially lose the ability to do a parameter estimation. But in this case, it's not really a problem. But you improve the goodness of fit. Okay. So the first four bins we kept the same. Then we combined from 4 to 7 keV, we combined pairs of bins because the energy resolution up here is somewhere like 1.5, 2 keV, whereas these bins were 0.5 keV, so much narrower than the energy resolution. Above 7 keV, we combined all of them together. And here are those fits in brown to the original set of bins, in black to this new set of bins. And you can see they're virtually identical. By combining the bins, we didn't actually hurt our ability to find this best fit point, find our two local minima. Now is look at your chi-square over degrees of freedom. Here, both cases were fairly good fits. But if we look down here, by removing a lot of excess bins that just add noise, your global fit, 7.3 over 6 degrees of freedom, is pretty good. But your secondary minimum, 9.7 over 6 degrees of freedom. This is starting to indicate the fit isn't that great. So you do have better power here. It's better. No, this, but in terms of the chi-square here, it actually fits worse. Because it's actually showing you're having a worse fit. No. You see, but if you just plug in your chi-square, what's the compatibility here? If you get a chi-square of 37 on 34 degrees of freedom, that's a great fit. That's perfectly fine. Go down here, 9.7 on 6 degrees of freedom. That's not as good.
So that's good. The reason why this thing works out actually is because again, in the one-bit data, they're essentially ignoring the error bars. So now, you've kind of literally, by adding wider bins, you somewhat accounted for that error bar, but in an inaccurate way. I mean, it's the best that you can do whenever you're given a plot of your data. So that's the reason why, whether this approach has some truth to it, but it's very relevant. It doesn't improve anything. It does in that the first one was like the morning error bar in the energy direction, where it gives inaccurately incorporating from that by making an uncertainty in the energy direction wider by having wider than. I think if you have, like you were saying earlier, you should get a better result by presenting the data. The only way that that's true is now you've incorporated rather than ignoring that in a very narrow way.
Okay. Well, I mean, basically what you have is you have up here, you have about 20, 25 bins that are fluctuating around zero. And what's your possible contribution to the chi-square from that? You can get a large fluctuation there. So when you're trying to look at your total chi-square, you have a larger range of possible chi-square that's reasonable to the total. Up here, this. It's not accidental. Whether you have signal or whether you have background, you expect this to be around zero. WIMPs can't give signal up there, right? So. I think it's consistent. But when we did this analysis, we didn't assume this particular data set. We scanned over all the parameter space and all the chi-square distributions. This is not particular to this data set. You really do get better sensitivity here by lowering the number of bins. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so here's the result in these regions with a good goodness of fit. You see that the regions get smaller here. And now the difference between the xenon exclusion curve and the allowed region for Dhamma has gotten a bit wider. Now it's a few GeV. So if you need to turn some knobs to try and get these things closer, now you have to turn them twice as far. Right? So by making a better choice of binning, you actually are showing that these results are a little more discrepant than you thought. Now, if you want to talk about this issue about the reduction number of bins, we can discuss that later. I can go into more detail on that. So I'm going to move on to the next part, which is looking at misleading and flawed uses of statistics. And for this, I'm going to go to the Cogent 2010 results. So this is the first result where they said they saw an excess of events. So here's their data in various energy bins. So different numbers of events in at different energies. And what you see in here is a double Gaussian peak from some cosmogenics radioactive decays here. On top of that, they said, oh, they have some flat background here, some exponential background here. And on top of that, there seems to be some excess number of low energy events down here. So then they go plot their exclusion curve. So the blue and the black are 90% exclusion curves. So everything above these curves are excluded at the 90% confidence level for two different data sets. Green region is Dhamma, which I think is a 3-sigma region. This here is the parameters that fit the two events that CDMS saw at the time. And this is the Cogent region of interest. Does anyone want to venture a guess as to what is the statistical meaning of this region? No one? All right, well, we'll take a look at that. It basically doesn't have a statistical meaning, is what I'm going to show. So what did they do? At each mass, what they did is they minimized the chi-square over the cross-section. So they're fixing the mass, minimize chi-square over the cross-section. And then they're looking for a 90% confidence interval over the cross-section based on that minimum. All right, so at each mass, they look for some interval. This is a roster scan. Well, the problem is a roster scan doesn't constrain the mass. So this is a little strange that these regions don't actually continue, because a roster scan covers all masses. So what is an actual region that would have 90% coverage? Here's what this region looks like. You have the roster scan covers these parameters and these parameters. So what did Cogent do? They looked at these regions and said, well, these regions, these intervals don't go to zero. These do, so we don't like these regions. We're just going to drop them out from our figure. Right? There's no statistical basis for doing that. Okay? Let's take a closer look at how they did these intervals here. And here's from their paper. You can actually look at the chi-square at two points at one particular mass. And I'll show that here. At a WIMP mass of 9 GeV, their chi-square minima had a value of 20.1. The null result with basically zero signal had a chi-square of 20.4. So when you're doing a delta chi-square on here, your 90% confidence interval should cover all parameters that give you a delta chi-square of less than 2.7. From here to here, the delta chi-square is 0.3. So I don't understand how you can say that this is 90% confidence interval here. It's less than a half sigma confidence interval. And there's I think I understand why this happened. But here now is what the actual roster scan gives you. This is the Cogent region. Basically, all they have is an upper limit. They don't have a lower limit. So this was the roster scan. If you do the analysis in terms of one of these goodness of fit regions or a delta chi-square region, you're going to get the same thing. So you can actually do a likelihood ratio test here. You have a global minimum, which was that 20.1. Your null hypothesis is chi-square of 20.4. If you want to go over both mass and cross-section parameters, your hypothesis ratio test of a WIMP versus no WIMP, background only, delta chi-square of 0.3 on 2 degrees of freedom, that's far less than a one sigma result. In fact, just random background fluctuations, you tend to do better than this improvement. Right? So basically, there's no preference for WIMPs in the way they analyze their data. So this, what they call region of interest, is not actually very interesting, statistically speaking. So how do you get this region back? You drop this exponential background that they added in. Right? So and that's what I think a lot of other people who have done these Cogent constraints is they put some constraint on how much that exponential background can contribute. That is not what Cogent did. They included an arbitrary exponential in this entire analysis. Right? Later analyses, 2011 and on, they dropped that out. They stopped including an exponential background. So. Let's see, in the interest of time, I'm going to sort of skip through, but you can look at the slides. There's a good reason why they had this flaw in their confidence intervals. And there's another mistake, statistical mistake in their paper. So that paper had lots of flaws in terms of how they handled the statistics. This misleading case where they dropped out the rest of the roster scan, and then some flaws in how they actually did the confidence intervals. So I'm going to go on to the next case, which is missing statistics. All right, and for this, I'm going to look at this maximum likelihood analysis of low-energy CDMS data. What Collier and Fields did was they took data from the CDMS low-energy analysis from various figures. They pulled out both the recoil energy and the ionization energy of various events seen in the CDMS detectors. And in these plots, well, you can see there's a bunch of events here. You have different background populations. Here you have electron recoil background population. Down here you have what's called the zero charge events. And then in this region here are what's called the surface events, which basically give you a long non-Gaussian tail to this electron recoil. All right, so those are the backgrounds that contribute to the events they see here at low energies. Now, if you have nuclear recoils like from WIMPs, you would expect them to appear somewhere around here along this nuclear recoil band. All right, so what these two did is they took this data and then came up with some models for the distribution of these various backgrounds, and then applied a likelihood analysis with and without nuclear recoils, looked to see if there was some preference for nuclear recoil case. But first, what did CDMS say about this region? This low energy region, the events that they saw in this nuclear recoil band, to them appeared reasonably consistent with background estimates, but they didn't have real detailed estimates of background population, so they didn't do a detailed analysis like this likelihood analysis. Instead, they limited themselves to generating constraints without background subtraction, so the conservative case. All right. But what Collier and Fields did is they did a fit to their models to with these background models to each of the detectors, and plus a fit to all the detectors combined, with and without a new population in this nuclear recoil band, which would be, say, the WIMPs. And what they find is that there's almost a six sigma preference for the model that includes the nuclear recoils over the background-only hypothesis, the null hypothesis. And they estimate nuclear recoil rate that you need above 3 keV for this new population. So the question is, has CDMS detected dark matter at 5 sigma? So let's take a little closer look. So what did the students do? They did this hypothesis test, background only versus background plus WIMPs. They did some parameter interval estimation of what the amount of these events need to be. What's missing is the goodness of fit. Now, why is that important? That's important because you have about 6,000 events in this analysis, and you're trying to explain about 200 of them with your potential signal. And this region here is well into the tails of this non-Gaussian distribution from these surface events. And you have significant contamination from these other populations down here. If you are not modeling that tail correctly, even if it's off by a little bit, you're almost guaranteed in a likely analysis to bias yourself towards finding something that isn't there. So the question is their model indicating evidence of a signal, or do they just have a very poor model fit, a very poor background model, where what you have is two very poor fits and one happens to be somewhat better than the other? And you can actually take a closer look here. So looking at the number of events they need to explain this excess, or the number of nuclear recoils that are consistent with the population they measure, global fit gives you a little under one event per kilogram per day. Right? That's their best fit for this new population of events. But they also did this fit for individual detectors, eight detectors. So you basically have eight independent measurements of this. Take this data here, and you can look at the fluctuations of these results about their best fit here. And what's the chi-square of that? It's about 30 on 8 degrees of freedom. It's a terrible fit. So what's the implication here? If they did their backgrounds correctly, if their models are OK, they have rejected the background case at 5 sigma. At the same time, they've excluded WIMPs at 3 sigma. Right? So, So really what you need is, what you need to do here is you need to include a goodness of fit test. I mean, the likelihood analysis, it's a good idea to do this, but you have to be careful. You need to be checking other things here. So Christoph and I are trying to look into this and do this analysis ourselves. So I'm just going to go through this real quick. The last case is, are we being overly conservative when we do these analyses? Now, so Raphael already talked about xenon. We have these various things going on. You have Poisson statistics in there because in a recoil event, you produce dozens and dozens of photons, but only about 1 in 20 of those photons actually trigger a PMT. Right? So you have lots of photons around, but you're only sensitive to a small fraction of them. So that's just the Poisson statistics there. You have this issue of this L effective. How much scintillation should we expect to see at different recoil energies? Louis was alluding to this, these energies that are talked about. So I'm going to go into that, take a quick look at what these energies are. Here's an example of xenon results. You have your S2 and S1. Here's the ratio of those two. And then you have your S1 signal. So you have all these different events in your data, S1 versus ratio of S2 to S1. This is the actual observable. Now, a lot of times, what they plot on here is another scale, which they call the energy. The more appropriate name for this would be a bad energy estimator, okay? Because there's lots of cases where this energy is not anywhere near to what the correct energy should be. The only place where this energy is appropriate is on the green line. Once you go off that green line, the energy is incorrect. And just to show you what's going on here, what I'm taking here is a bunch of events at the same energy. And this is just showing the random distribution due to Poisson fluctuations, your PMT response. And what you can see here is that they appear at a wide range of S1 and this ratio here. But it's not vertical. It's not horizontal. Events at one energy sort of follow a band down here. Okay? All right, so here on the green line, you'd have one particular energy here. Other events at that energy, which is supposedly 7 keV, would appear somewhere around here. So you can have something over here, which is really a 7 keV recoil, but you're calling it a 15 keV recoil. Okay? And so this is what Peter Sorensen was pointing out, is that when you plot these things, here's where your real energies are, right? Lines of constant recoil energy follow these contours. They're not vertical lines like suggested by these axes that are often shown. Okay? All right, and just last point, I just want to look at one of the considerations here, this L effective. There's two issues in these L effective measurements. One is you have lots of different measurements that are somewhat discrepant here. And then you have the issue of what is going on down here at very low energies below where we have any actual measurements. And really, this is the more important issue. What is going on down here? We don't have measurements below 3 keV. So the concern done is just treat this as going to zero, which basically means if you have nuclear recoils below 3 keV, they'll produce no scintillation. You'll never see them. Is that really consistent with what we know is going on? We take it to be zero, but is that too conservative? And it pretty much is. And here's the lowest energy data point. Measurement of this L effective gives you events that would appear around here. Events at the same energy sort of follow this contour. Any events down here would be coming from something below 3 keV. Right? And what you can sort of make out is in the red and the boxes here, this is nuclear recoil calibration data. Right? So they put in a neutron source and generate a bunch of events. What you see here, you have pink and gray regions. You have lots of nuclear recoils occurring down here. These are coming from events below 3 keV. You're getting scintillation from those events. You are seeing something. The real problem is that it's hard to make a good quantitative estimate of what LF is down there, which is why it's typically ignored. But there is a non-zero LF, and that's rather important. And as Raphael pointed out, they did their calibration studies, which also show that LF is non-zero below 3 keV, at least to some point. Now, why is that important? This is a rather old slide, but these three green curves are constraints from xenon 10 for three different parameterizations of what's going on below this, at the very lowest energies here. And you can see they make it makes a significant difference. The one on the right is the most conservative case, which back then did a cutoff at 4 keV, because that's as far as the data went. But just to go through this quickly. So can we use L-effective to try and reconcile experimental results? Well, the thing is that the assumptions we're already making are very conservative. We're excluding things that we know. We know we can get signal below 3 keV, maybe down to 2 keV, maybe 1 keV, but there's definitely some signal down there. And so the assumptions we've made are very conservative. So it's, you basically can't make those constraints weaker. Once you handle all the physics appropriately, once we know what's going on with L effective, it's very likely that those constraints are going to get much stronger. Right? So you can't use L-effective to say, oh, maybe we can shift xenon down to weaker constraints and then everything's okay. It's just not going to happen that way. I'll skip the last point. Just to summarize then, and we have these weak statistical tests and possibly being overly conservative in some cases. And then we get constraints that appear to be compatible. We just have to be cautious that we're not being overly conservative to get these compatibility regions. And I guess one of the main points is a lot of these things, you need to look at the goodness of fit here. I guess that's the main point. And that's it. Thank you.
So of course, one issue with goodness of fit is that we all use chi-square, which has some limits to its applicability.
Right.
So if you had some sort of model for the backgrounds, you could do some sort of Bayesian model selection thing. But I guess the problem for everyone is that the backgrounds are just still a challenge to model.
Yeah, it is. Some of the experiments do better at that, right? So xenon likelihood analysis and CDMS has their likelihood analysis, but then we don't have access to all that data.
Yeah, but I think maybe in the future, if we have tons of data, maybe the chi-square will be better, but I think maybe in the future doing a Bayesian model selection thing might be a little more robust. But of course, then you have to have a background model, so I don't know, but.
Yeah, so several analyses are not chi-square, right? So the likelihood analysis, low energy CDMS is not chi-square. Xenon analysis is not chi-square, but definitely DAMA. The bend ones are, it's easier for us to work with, right?
Uh, There's been a lot of recent discussion about xenon 10, about how those constraints were are actually weaker than people thought. Can you tell me why that also doesn't apply to xenon 100?
Oh yeah.
Oh, did I? I'm sorry. I was late this morning. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they don't apply at all. Okay, so there's can we make a clear distinction between xenon 10, xenon 100, please? It's two completely different collaborations. The xenon 10 collaboration has ceased to exist, unfortunately. So, and it has absolutely nothing at all to do with xenon 100, please. It just happens to share the name. The xenon 10 analysis was published after the experiment had been dismantled. It's basically a PhD student's thesis work, and he made that analysis and he put that out. And at the time when both collaborations had moved on, half of it with the Lux experiment, the other half with the xenon 100 experiment, and please correct me if somebody has another take on this. I'm not sure how much of that was cross-checked. What happened to the xenon 10 limit? There's two things to say. One is that the xenon 10 limit that we are discussing there is the S2 only analysis. And if in papers written about the caveats that you have in this particular analysis, it is more tricky. It's also a reduced set of data. And finally, what happened now recently is that there was simply a software bug in the code that was used to produce the limit. The guy who did it had cross-checked it with the, you know, Yellen methods, right? This is really old style. So this was done with the Yellen method, and he had cross-checked his code using the maximum gap method, but then the limit was produced with the optimum interval, and that had somewhere, some really just typo bug in the software. So that is why the limit is is overstated. So the xenon 10 collaboration, or what is left of it, namely the email list, has revised it, has put out an errata, which is on the archive. Well, it does weaken it considerably. At the same time, the tension is still there. The question then is what other systematics that are involved in that. Again, S2 only analysis, which is very, very different from what we are doing in xenon 100 or in Lux.
Another question. You showed spin independent. Do you have similar plots for spin dependent, comparing with the new binning of DAMA versus xenon and stuff like that?
I don't have plots of that. Kelsa and I sort of looked at comparisons of you know, what you can do with this with a new lower threshold. We did make comparisons between spin independent and spin dependent. And it looks like with a lower threshold, you can actually get a preference for one or the other in your fits. Slight preference, so maybe 2 sigma preference for one versus the other by having this lower threshold. And that's because you have contributions from both iodide and sodium, and the relative contributions are different in spin independent versus spin dependent. So you do expect different shapes to appear at the low energies.
So you made a point in your CDMS slide about how the background's excluded at 5 sigma, but WIMPs are excluded at 3 sigma, and you almost said it like it was a bad thing. and I shouldn't say this in this audience, but yeah, there are tons of other non-WIMP dark matter models, and so it's not necessarily a bad thing to say that it excludes WIMPs at 3 sigma. Right, and so then there's the question, where do you draw the line? You analyze every model and you say...
Yeah. Well, so that analysis was basically an effective dark matter result. They were just looking at whether there was something in a nuclear that gives a nuclear recoil that has some sort of exponential profile, which I guess mostly WIMP models, you would expect that. Somewhat generic, but that whole exclusion thing of excluding WIMPs at 3 sigma, I mean, that's making this big assumption that they're That's making the assumption that they modeled the backgrounds correctly, which, as far as I can tell from talking to CDMS people, they didn't. What they used to model those backgrounds, that tail is wrong. It doesn't match their data. So I wouldn't read too much into that, excluding WIMS.
I have a couple of general, like, methodological points. Following on what Annika said about, you know, doing Bayesian model comparison instead, of course, whatever you do, you need a likelihood function. The Bayesian approach doesn't do without. So I share your concern that if you don't have access to all of these data sets and all the detailed background data, et cetera, then you can't, if you don't have a proper likelihood, there is a limit to what you can do. And certainly, you have to do some sort of model checking. But perhaps more generally than goodness of fit. In other words, in the Bayesian framework, because you always do model comparison, one of the models always comes out on top. And so the usual criticism is that you might have a bunch of models, none of them is a good description of your data, but then one of them will come out on top, and so you're going to reject all the others and just go with the one that's best among a bad bunch of models, so you want to avoid that. But maybe goodness of fit, because the likelihood function is not that well understood in some cases, might not be the way to go, because if you can't model your experiment, you can't model the likelihood in detail, your chi-square degree of freedom might just be as misleading a quantity as anything else. But there are other internal checks that you can do to your model, for example, bootstrapping of your data or predictive p-values, or things like that you can do to the data themselves to do model checking rather than the goodness of fit. So perhaps even precisely because we don't have enough details, I think, to do a proper job of this hard job of doing a proper goodness of fit test, perhaps more basic model, even more basic model checking steps would be appropriate at this stage.
Yeah, what do you think? Yeah. So it doesn't have to be just goodness of fit. You just need to be looking at whether these things really are working. And definitely this likelihood analysis, that one is something you can do with the goodness of fit. They made a claim there that they could have checked to see if it was reasonable by looking at the goodness of fit, and they didn't. But yeah, I mean, any type of check is better than none.
So just to summarize the binning discussion, since we have a few more minutes left, statistically speaking, there should be absolutely no way that binning your data more gives you a more truthful representation of your results. Now, as I was alluding to, what is ignored in their binning analysis is that uncertainty in the error distribution. What you were saying is that their energy resolution is much worse than the size of their bins. And so a better thing to do rather than your binning analysis would be to, for each of their data points, you add an error in the energy direction, which is, I don't know what function it takes as energy, but you add those, and then you do two error component analysis fit to that. And that would be even better than joining two bins together. What would be even better than that is ignoring their work until they make it public and you can do a proper unbin analysis. But in all seriousness, add error bars in the other dimension, and that will give you a more truthful result than combining bins. It's still inaccurate because you have data at the edge and you don't.
When you calculate the predicted spectrum that you're comparing against the bins, you are folding in the energy resolution, these error bars. So you are factoring that in.
Okay, then you shouldn't do better by binning the data.
No, this is well known. Chi-square goodness of fit is can be improved by doing things with the binning. Yeah, but we already know that the signal is only in the lowest 6 or 7 bins. It's never going to be in the upper bins. But you can calculate this all out. You can do this analysis yourself. You find you get better statistical power by combining the upper bins.
So can you show us the difference between the expected results?
What do you mean, the difference between expected?
I was concerned that you had perhaps tuned this, your reanalysis to the observed data, which
absolutely
is always dangerous.
Not. Absolutely not.
And you said that you expected results. Show us the expected and the observed?
Yeah, so we were definitely careful. We did this in an a priori way. Right? We did not base our binning on the data we actually saw. The only thing we did take was the size of the error bars, which presumably would not change with other data sets, with other realizations. So, so this is.
These are expected or observed?
So this is applying our new binning to the observed data.
Okay. But the binning is derived from expected results under what hypothesis?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, so the choice of binning was a little bit by hand for the energy resolution part. The part here where we combined everything together above some energy, that we scanned over entire WIMP parameter space, looked at the chi-square distributions of the expected data you get from those, and the likelihood of different results you would get. We scanned over all possible results. So not one, not this particular result. We looked at all possible results. We looked at, in this case, we looked at basically the p-value of what you can get when you combine bins at different energies. We looked at we looked for the ones that give the best p-value. We did that over the entire parameter space. There are points in parameter space where it's actually better to combine them down to an even lower energy. But 7 basically covers all of the parameter space. So it was sort of a conservative choice.
Okay, we're just going to do one more question in the back here because it's almost time to break for lunch.
Okay. Well, it's more common. I just want to say, it seems to me that when you're rebeaming, you have different results just because the smallest bin is getting more weight, because you rebeam into 7. I guess that's the only reason that the dotted line become less good fit, right? Because now you got more weight on your smallest bin, which constrain the bin on the very left, right? Because you not only have 7 bins or 6 bins. So it's just like reweighting the bins, right?
In some sense, yeah.
Okay, well, I guess we can always continue that discussion over lunch. So let's thank Chris one more time and enjoy the lunch break.